This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. What if comparing car insurance rates was as easy as putting on your favorite podcast? With Progressive, it is. Just visit the Progressive website to quote with all the coverages you want. You'll see Progressive's direct rate, then their tool will provide options from other companies so you can compare. All you need to do is choose the rate and coverage you like. Quote today at progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Comparison rates not available in all states or situations. Prices vary based on how you buy.
What kind of programs does this school have? How are the test scores? How many kids do a classroom? Homes.com knows these are all things you ask when you're home shopping as a parent. That's why each listing on Homes.com includes extensive reports on local schools, including photos, parent reviews, test scores, student-teacher ratio, school rankings, and more. The information is from multiple trusted sources and curated by Homes.com's dedicated in-house research team. It's all so you can make the right decision for your family. Homes.com. We've done your homework.
What is Dax, are you?
Tracking all our cars on Carvana Value Tracker on all our devices? Yes, Kristen, yes I am.
Well, I've been looking for my phone for...
In Dax's domain, we see all, so we always know what our cars are worth.
All of them?
All of them. Value surge, trucks up 3.9%.
That's a great offer.
I know. Sell?
Sell.
Track your car's value with Carvana Value Tracker today.
Hi, everybody. Welcome back to Power Players, powered by Radio.com. I am your hostess with the mostest, Danielle McCartan, DMC. This is episode 8, and I have a very special guest for you today. As always, world championship, now silver medal winner, and a 2-time Olympic distance runner, Kara Goucher. Kara, thanks for joining the show. I'm so excited to have you on.
Thank you. I'm excited to be on.
So we got to start here. I'm in the New York, New Jersey area, and I know you were born in Queens, and I wanted to first ask you about the New York City Marathon. It's the 50th anniversary of it this year, and as far as we know, it's still a go for November 1st, despite this coronavirus stuff. In the past, there's been 50,000 runners. Yet here in this area, we can't even have outdoor gatherings with more than 25 people. Do you think the race will still happen?
You know, I don't know. We want races back, but I don't see a situation where we can have 50,000 people lining up. So I know they're kicking around ideas like just an elite field, but I think that would be kind of sad because one of the like beautiful things about the New York City Marathon is that it brings all those people together. I'm not feeling really confident that any major marathons are going to be run this year, but I hope I'm wrong.
Since it doesn't sound like it's decided yet, what changes would you like to see implemented so that maybe it still could happen? You mentioned the elite field, but what spectators? Probably not, right?
Yeah, I mean, I guess if you don't have spectators lined up, that's a safer, quote-unquote, experience. But that robs you of the experience of running in the streets of New York and coming off the Queensboro Bridge and all of those things. I don't know. Can you have a New York City Marathon without all those elements? I guess so, but it wouldn't really feel like the New York City Marathon, I don't think.
What about, I've seen this idea kicked, a virtual marathon. That's obviously not the same, but do you think people would go for that?
I mean, I think people are desperate just to do something. So I think we've seen a huge uptick in virtual marathons and virtual races right now. And I can see them doing that. I feel like it's harder with these iconic races, a New York or a Boston, that are so iconic and so much a part of our history in the U.S. as runners. And it's harder for them to do a virtual race because people want to go to New York and they want to have that experience. That is, of course, an option. But I feel like for these bigger iconic races that it's harder.
I have a listener question. Erin from Palisades Park, New Jersey. She's an avid runner who thinks, by the way, that this is a quote, you're amazing. She wants to know what your favorite workout is, and I assume because she's going to want to try it.
Oh my gosh. Well, it depends on what I would be training for. You know, when I was on the track, I really loved mile repeats, and I also loved speed work, 200s and 300s and 400s. When I was training for the marathon, I really liked long repeats. So I liked 2-mile repeats or 5K repeats. Just kind of depends. Like right now, I'm trying to get a little speed back. I'm trying to run a quick mile for myself. So I've been doing speed work again, which is fun. I've always liked repeats. I like the brain numbingness of repeats and just getting in a groove and just knocking them out.
I've been looking up some dates here. You had your son and then competed in the London Olympics 2 years later. I mean, That's some like superhuman stuff. Like, how were you able to bounce back into Olympic shape so quickly?
Yeah, you know, I would not recommend that. I mean, I gave birth to my son in September of 2010, and I ran the Boston Marathon 6.5 months later. And, you know, it set me up for a lot of injuries. So I definitely would not recommend it. I think as a female athlete, you know, we don't have maternity protection. I was trying to get back and prove that I still had value. I think if I was ever to do it again, I would listen to my body a little bit more. But your body is an amazing thing, and it will come back. I think at the Olympic Games, my son was about 22 months old, maybe. And at that point, I really felt like myself again. I mean, I totally felt like myself. It took me about a year. Be patient, be gentle with yourself. And I felt so much stronger after I had my son.
For me, I know Erin from Palisades Park is an avid runner. She posts stuff all the time about running. But for me, I'm not a runner. Like, the sports I played in high school did not involve distance whatsoever. I had played softball, I played volleyball, I played basketball. So I've been actually in this quarantine running 2 miles pretty much every day. How can I kind of take it to the next level? I change it up a little bit. I'm getting a little bit bored, I'll be honest.
Well, first of all, that's awesome. You sound a lot like my sister, who was a really great basketball, soccer, softball player. And she has taken up running in quarantine as well, which is shocking to me that at 43 years old, she's decided to give this running thing a try. So right now you have a good base, right? You can run 2 miles a day or every other day or so, and that's great. And now you want to shake it up. So maybe you want to try to go 3 or 4 miles. Maybe one day you want to do some strides, which is where you're jogging along and then you pick it up for 20 seconds. You run harder for 20 seconds. Just start introducing a little bit longer runs and also some change in your pace. It'll be more fun, and it'll also help your fitness come along even quicker.
All right, I'm gonna try that. I'm gonna have to tweet that to you, see how that works out for me.
Okay.
So we originally connected on this 30 for 30, this Lance Armstrong special. Episode 1 was this past Sunday. Episode 2 is this upcoming Sunday. And I know you watched it. I actually watched it last night without the commercials. I DVR it all the time. But what are your, I guess, first initial thoughts on what was presented in episode 1?
Not a lot of surprises. I hoped that we were going to hear from the Betsy Andreos, the Emma O'Reillys, and the Floyd Landises more, the Tyler Hamiltons, the people who told the truth. And maybe that'll come in episode 2. And then, of course, I had hoped that Lance would show a lot of remorse, you know, regret for the way he treated people. And so I don't know. There hasn't been a lot of surprises. It's a little frustrating to see him be highlighted again in the same situation. And I want the 30 for 30 for all of the other people who helped expose the doping in cycling. I would like to see a 30 for 30 on them.
You know, there was one thing that kind of struck me. It was rather like, I would say unremarkably, he said that in his first pro season, he used, and this is a quote, drugs that stimulate your body's own production of cortisone. Now, first, for those of us, me included, what does a stimulation in cortisone mean for an athlete competing in an individual sport? How is that an advantage?
It's just the beginning of cheating, right? I mean, cortisol helps you in fight and flight and things like that. So I'm assuming it would be helpful in a race situation or a hard workout situation to help you be able to go harder and longer. That was the first time I had heard him admit that he doped his first season as a pro. And of course, there's rumors that, you know, that the EPO started a lot earlier than he said there. He has former teammates and massage therapists that say it started earlier. But I was a little like, okay, good. He at least admitted that he has never been a professional athlete clean. So for me, it begs the question of, well, how good was he? If you're taking drugs from the get-go, I mean, you know, a lot of people like to argue with me on social media that, you know, he would have won regardless. But the thing is, we don't get to know now because we learned that he was cheating from the very beginning. It's really interesting the emotions that people have behind it and how angry they are when I talk about it. It's, you know, like good people make bad choices. Bad people make good choices. And just, you know, I'm not saying he's a bad human, but I'm just saying let's take the emotion out of it and let's look at his career. It's stained. The entire career is stained. And so it's really hard to really look at anything that he did in his career with any admiration.
So I listened to your podcast, the whole thing. You have a podcast called Clean Sport Collective. And the latest episode was with Floyd Landis. He was the winner of the 2006 Tour de France, who exposed the widespread doping in cycling. And one word I kind of opened my notes in my phone as he was talking, he used the word institutional. And he said, this is a quote from him, literally everyone was in on it. There was no solution. In that moment,
right.
Kara, when he was talking to you, was that statement something that you had believed or happened to agree with or disagree with?
Yeah, look, I used to be really black and white on this, and I still am. If you dope, you're out. I don't have any patience for it. But I changed a little bit where I have become a little bit more empathetic. I do think he was in a situation where everyone was doping. Did he still have a choice? Of course he did. He could go home. He could say, I'm not going to do that. But I've become a little bit more empathetic where when you feel like there's nowhere to turn, of course there's still a choice, but I can see how they justify it to themselves. And I appreciated him really walking us through his justification, because when he first was a professional, he was trying to do it clean. He was racing for Motorola and they were trying to do it clean. And then he made the decision that I'm going to go to U.S. Postal Team and I'm going to cheat. That's not okay. But I think it's interesting talking to people who are willing to talk us through that, because like I have this podcast, The Clean Sport Collective, and our goal is to highlight clean athletes. But if we never talk to people who made the wrong choices, then how can we really learn how to prevent it in the future? And I think Floyd was talking about how there was just no one there to tell him don't do it. And that's the same conversation I had with Tyler Hamilton. And again, it doesn't excuse it, but it really needs to be a culture shift. There are clean athletes in cycling. Unfortunately, they never make it to the Peloton or the Tour de France because they're held down by people who are doping.
For the listeners, and if you guys want to check out her podcast, it's called Clean Sport Collective again. But Landis, he cited two reasons for the doping. You said just, you know, go home, but there's a financial gain. There's bonuses for placing, for winning, whatever, you know better than me. And there's also doing it to level the playing field. So do you feel, I mean, there's any validity in the justification?
No. I mean, look, I get that you want the money and it can change your life. And we see this in running a lot, especially athletes from East Africa. They win a marathon and their families are set up for generations. There's incentive there to do things to cut corners because of the financial benefit. And Floyd talked about that, right? Like he went from scraping by to making a lot of money. There's a lot of incentive behind it. But you know, this whole level the playing field thing, it really irritates me because it doesn't. It just doesn't. Everybody responds to drugs differently. So some people get a much bigger benefit from EPO than others. Some people have just a naturally higher hemoglobin. So if they take EPO, they're not going to get the kind of benefits of someone that has a naturally lower hemoglobin level. And same with testosterone and HGH. So you're not really leveling anything. And at this point, it really becomes who has the most money, who's willing to take the most risk. Floyd was talking about when he got to Postal Service, they had a team doctor who was monitoring them constantly so they could dope, quote unquote, safely. It just really becomes then about a money, like who the richer athletes are going to do well. I really can't stand that leveling playing field argument. It really falls flat on every area for me.
I want to put that out there. Me too. But as he was talking, I'm a big baseball fan, and I was thinking about the steroid era in baseball and how much Landis is similar to a guy like Jose Canseco, who ultimately in his book obviously made money off of it, but he told how widespread PEDs in baseball were. So since it's so widespread, and if you're not doing it, I guess you would not be able to beat out the guy above you for a spot on a roster or a bonus or a contract. It's just, I cannot wrap my mind around something like that, I guess, is what I'm trying to say.
Yeah, no, it's a conundrum. And I feel like it really needs to be a culture shift. There needs to be a shift from us as fans. Like, what do we want to see? Do we want to see slower races that we know are clean and not as many home runs, but we know they're clean? Or are we going to keep talking about records all the time? A lot of it falls on us too. Like, are we willing to turn the other way for entertainment? What do we truly care about? Do we really want to be telling young kids, well, you have to dope to make it in cycling and baseball and in running? Like, it's just, that's how it is. Like, what are we doing? There needs to be an overall culture shift. And I appreciate Tyler Hamilton and Floyd Landis. They got caught, and there's a good chance they never would have said anything if they hadn't gotten caught. But mm-hmm. I do appreciate them willing to pull that curtain back and say, hey, you know what? This can't keep going on. And we need to learn from people like that so that we can change it for the future.
So the Nike Oregon Project, very important to you. But this is a quote from your former coach, Alberto Salazar. And he said, no athlete within the Oregon Project uses a medication against the spirit of the sport we love. What does that make you feel?
It's just a blatant lie. I mean, I think there was leaked USADA report. They're trying to take these infusions above the legal limit to get an advantage. It's just a lie. But that's what he's done. And that's what that team has done. And that's what Lance did until he couldn't lie anymore. And that's what Floyd did. And that's what Tyler did, right? They just lie. I was on that team. I watched people taking prescription drugs they didn't need. I watched people taking inhalers they didn't need. I watched people fake dehydration to get IVs they didn't need. Those are the facts. I testified about it, and there's an appeal, and I'll have to testify it again. But you know, it is sort of a he said, she said in public opinion, and some people agree with me and some people don't.
But you had, I was reading about your relationship with Salazar, and he was like a father figure for you. So that must have been like Oh, that must have been tough.
Oh, yeah. Oh, no, it was terrible. I mean, it's funny now to be so removed from him and his life, but, you know, he really was like a father to me. And we wrote very personal letters to each other, and I confided in him in so much of my life. You know, my father died when I was 4 years old, and he really filled that void for me. And there was so much trust. It's really hard to describe to people. It's like finding out that your dad is a criminal, but like a really bad one. And then being put in this position of looking the other way because you love him so much and you don't want to see any harm, or doing what you know in your gut is right. It's taken years. And I mean, even now, like when I had to testify in front of him, it was like a traumatic experience for me. And I'm sure it will be again when I have to do it again.
I didn't know about the appeal. Like, what is the whole process now? The appeal, the timeline of it, and what are you expected to say or do now?
It went in front of the American Arbitration Association, and he was given a 4-year ban. He didn't like that, so he has appealed it. Now we go in front of CAS, which is the Court of Arbitration of Sport, and whatever is decided here is final. There's no appeal for this. So it looks like it's going to be this fall. So we'll have the whole hearing all over again. And first time I testified, like 3.5-4 hours, and I'll have to do it all over again, and in front of 3 new arbitrators. And USADA is not backing down. Those of us that testified are not backing down. And he and with Nike's backing are not backing down. So yeah, we get to do it all over again.
Wow. And with Nike's backing, that's like a David and Goliath sort of feel.
Yeah, I mean, it felt like that the whole time, right? There was a lot of people upset because it took 6-7 years for this all to happen. I mean, it was about 6 years before he was charged, and then we had the hearing, and it was another year plus, almost a year and a half after we had the hearing, but before a decision was made. You know, a lot of people are mad at USADA, but they had no control. Nike tried to block it left and right, and it is very much David and Goliath. I mean, when I testified, you know, there was 9 people on his team and 3 people on USADA's team. But the thing is, when you have the truth on your side, you can get through the situation of being financially inferior. When you have the truth on your side, and you have people willing to tell the truth. I mean, that's how he got his ban in the first place.
And it's not just him, too. I just want the listening audience to know that it was Coach Salazar's, I'm going to call him experiments, and it was Dr. Jeffrey Brown's, kind of call him treatments, in quotes. But one thing I didn't totally understand was, what was Salazar trying to accomplish with trafficking in this testosterone? What was the point of that? How does that help?
That's a great question, because first of all, testosterone is a banned substance. So why is he trafficking it? Why does he have it around his athletes? There's been a lot from his side saying, well, we were just doing experiments to find out how much it would take to test positive, just in case someone ever tried to sabotage you. But it's just so ludicrous.
But was it muscle cream or something?
Yeah, so it's called androgel. So it's testosterone in a cream form. So you could just massage it into someone and they would get the benefits of taking testosterone and recover better. But he didn't really have to answer for that in the AAA report. So it will be interesting to see what happens in the appeal.
Now, the CEO of Nike at the time was Mark Parker, and I saw an article where he wrote an email with the following sentence in it. It will be interesting to determine the minimal amount of topical male hormone required to create a positive test. Was it possible at all that maybe Parker didn't know the full extent of what was going on?
No. I mean, look, that was really hard for me to see, because I really like Mark Parker and I really like his family. I really believed he would be above that. But you're dealing with professional athletes. Testosterone is banned in every single sport. There's 0% chance that you're confused of if this experiment should be taking place or not. And I think that just shows that these things go all the way to the top. These people are protected all the way to the top. And the most powerful athletes are with the most powerful brands, and they're going to do whatever it takes to protect them. But no, unfortunately, no, there's no excuse. Once you know that someone is doing a testosterone experiment to see how much it takes to test positive, and they're doing it in the Nike campus and the Nike lab, I mean, that sounds like a reason to be fired to me.
Having laid all that out, would you use the same term that Landis used, which was institutional?
Yeah, I mean, maybe I'm naive, but I do feel like they're, you know, in track and field, it's definitely a very dirty sport, but I do feel like there are programs and teams that are still doing it ethically. And, you know, I ran for that team. I mean, I was already target tested by USADA because an investigation had already started before I ever knew. But I signed over all of my personal blood work over the years. I mean, I would get my blood work done like every 6 weeks to make sure my iron stores were good, to make sure my cortisol wasn't too high, like I wasn't stressed or whatever. So I handed all that over to USADA and I was like, please go through this and tell me. And they gave me a clean bill of health. There were people on that team that are 100% innocent and clean. It's not like the Tour de France where everyone's doing it. I don't think it's that bad, but I think it's select people who are definitely protected, who, yeah, are in pretty deep at this point.
I mean, obviously you're a clean athlete. Were you approached to do something that either you didn't want to do or you knew it was wrong? And I know that you said no, but were you approached with it, and what was it?
Yeah, it was my last year at the Oregon Project. I was asked to take a thyroid medication that I didn't have a prescription for. A few months later, I was asked to take a supplement that I didn't know what it was at the World Championships. And that really was just like, that was the end for me. At that point, I was 33 years old, and I had lived my entire life being proud of being clean and being proud of never skirting any line. I tried to ignore the first suggestion of a medication that I didn't have a prescription for, and then with the second one, it was just nail in the coffin. I have to get out of here. It was really sad, and I feel like I was groomed over a period of years to be ready for that, but I feel grateful that I had such a history of people in my life with integrity, and I feel grateful that I was married to my husband, who is vocal about anti-doping. I feel grateful that that was the history I had, because if I didn't have that history, who knows what would have happened, because it was definitely a grooming process to get me ready for it.
That's amazing that this sounds like a predatory grooming process.
Yeah, I mean, it's just like a slow process, right? And it starts with something simple as a prescription, and then it's IV with something, and then the next thing you know, like, you've crossed every line and now you're in deep.
So I guess that second prescription was the moment where you were like, okay, I'm doing this. I have to say something.
Yeah. I mean, I'm going to be real honest. I didn't say anything. I just left the team and I told my husband I can't do this anymore. And my husband knew, but we didn't tell anyone why I was leaving. We blamed it on that we had a baby, that we needed a change of scenery. And that was in the end of 2011. And it wasn't until 2013 that I went to authorities. I was just scared. I was scared that I would lose my contract. I was scared that I would be blacklisted from races. But in 2013, I really just couldn't take it anymore. It's kind of ironic, the Lance thing, because I was watching him on Oprah, and it must have been like late January or February of 2013, and I just couldn't stand it anymore. And after he had been interviewed, I saw Travis Tiger, the CEO of USADA, on, talking about the Armstrong case, talking about getting death threats, talking about seeing it through. I just told my husband, I said, I was in the Springs training for the Boston Marathon, and I just said, if you get me that guy, I'm going in. And he did. He got in contact with Travis Tygart, and a couple weeks later, I was in the USADA offices in front of their lawyers telling my side of the story.
I was thinking, Mark McGuire and Sammy Sosa, that both PED users, okay, whether they admit it or not, they brought more popularity to the game of baseball. You've called Salazar, like, this is a quote, a win-at-all-cost person, and it's hurting the sport. But the idea behind this Oregon project, with Nike's backing in 2001, was to return American distance running to prominence. And that was accomplished. It's irrefutable. So my question to you is, without the help of these experiments and these treatments, could the sport have achieved as much popularity to the extent that it actually ended up growing to?
Yeah, I mean, that's a great question. It's kind of philosophical, right? That is how we tell these stories and how we champion athletes or don't champion athletes. You know, I won a medal for the Oregon Project clean at a world championship, and that catapulted us. And it was sort of a double-edged sword. It was amazing because it pushed U.S. distance running forward. We hadn't won a medal at a championship in 15 years or something crazy like that, or 12 years. But then we've won one at every single championship since in the distances. So it really did push running forward. But it also changed the culture dramatically of our team. You were no longer patted on the back and celebrated for making a world championship team. You needed to win a medal. I just feel like it's tough because, yeah, those things bring a lot of attention. And obviously the Oregon Project had a lot of success after I left with a lot more medals. And it does bring attention. But what has it really done for American distance running? I mean, I don't really think, and I could be wrong, but I don't think that most kids are like, I want to be like those guys. I think they're more saying, I want to be like the Jenny Simpsons and the Emma Coburns and the other athletes of the world that are outspoken about doping, that has really made that a badge of honor, that I care that my sport is clean.
I saw another quote from you too, and we already talked about maybe being blacklisted, but this is what you said: standing up for what you believe in can be scary and lonely, but it also can set you free. I'm curious to know, like, were there or what were the ramifications that you felt for bringing the situation to light?
Yeah, I mean, I had been at Nike for 12 and a half years, and I had lived in Oregon for 10 years, and I was no longer welcome. I had to sort of like pack up. I mean, I chose to leave, but I really lost, you know, my friends, community. And I was still in touch a little bit with some of them, but the like 90% of my friends turned their back on me. And then I started having a hard time getting into certain races. Then, you know, I've even had death threats. So it just sort of like built over time. But, you know, like I would see on message boards some of the most famous photographers in the business bashing me, or race directors bashing me openly on Facebook and things like that. That's a lot to take, you know, like I'm like, oh, well, now I can't go race there, even though I was planning on racing there.
Right.
And there were even races where I went where the meet directors told me that Salazar had asked that I be held out of the race. It just became this really difficult situation where I don't know who to trust. I don't know who's really on my side. Even now, I always feel a little unsafe when I'm out, you know, at races. But I'm not going to let them take that from me. But I don't know who believes me and who doesn't, really.
What do you mean unsafe during a race?
Look, crazy things have happened. And like I said, I've had threats against me. And I go to races mostly now just to be a spectator and a fan. But I always feel a little uncomfortable. I'm just, you know, there's crazy people out there. And there's people who don't want to see their heroes fall. They want to paint me as just this bitter, angry woman that can't let it go, instead of someone that's just trying to do the right thing for the future of the sport. And again, the people that I'm up against are at the top of the sport. I mean, it's Nike. It's not like it's some small brand. It's just always a little bit of me that's nervous that, like, have I made too many enemies?
Wow. Well, I have a listener question from Vanessa from Florida. She's actually a track and field coach, and she would like to understand more in a positive light the importance of your mentoring the young women in the sport. And she actually asked particularly about Mary Kane.
Yeah, look, I think it's really important that we're there for each other. I didn't have that many mentors. When I was coming up, it was sort of like we were at this weird place where we could only have one star. And so the mentors that I had, I just loved to this day. Like Joan Benoit-Samuelson was one of those people that really encouraged me. And being able to train, honestly, being able to train with Shalane Flanagan, where we were both going for the same Olympic team spot. We were both going for the same podium, but we decided to do it together. And those experiences have really changed my life profoundly. And I think it's really important that this next generation coming up knows that we can help them. Also, one thing I love about the generation now is that we have so many stars. And everyone realizes that if Shalane wins New York and if Des Linden wins Boston, one doesn't subtract from the other. They're just both freaking awesome athletes. And I don't feel like it used to be like that, but I feel like it's definitely shifted that way now. Now is the time to really support each other. Because we can do big things. As far as Mary Kane, you know, she went to the program that I left, and I always worried about her, always. And I had never met her, not once. And I just decided to follow her on Instagram a few years ago, thinking, you know, maybe someday she's going to need someone to help her. She ended up reaching out. I just adore her. I think she's doing so much to change the culture in sport, as far as like abuse against women in the sport and this culture of like being so obsessed with people's bodies. And so I just want to help elevate her voice, and I want to help elevate all the women running well. And I feel like it's just more of a team atmosphere now. The women really seem to support each other and want to see each other succeed. And I love that.
And for all your troubles, I guess, Kara, karma finally rewarded you. Talk about your trip to London in 2017.
Oh, yeah. So in 2007, I won the bronze medal at the World Championships. And it was the happiest day of my life. It was very unexpected. I felt so grateful. It was the slowest championship race on record. And I just raced really savvy. And I was able to kick my way into a medal. And it changed my life profoundly. I mean, I started making money, started flying on the Nike jet. It changed my life in a very big way. Before that, I couldn't get into a race unless my husband was running the race, really. It would be like he was the bigger star, and I couldn't get into a race unless he was also going to race there. And then after that, just all these doors opened. I could run wherever I wanted. And it was such an amazing experience for me, and I never looked back on it, not one time in any negative light. And then in 2017, I get home from a run, and I have a phone call from a reporter from Sports Illustrated. He said, "How does it feel to be world silver medalist?" And I was like, "What?" So there's a 10-year statute of limitations on all medals. So if they discover that someone doped 11 years after the fact, it's too late, which I don't agree with, but that's just how it is. So they have started retesting samples 8 years out. So when you're running at the World Championships, you get tested before competition. And then if you do well, you get blood and urine tested after the race. And they store those samples for 10 years. And so they had retested some of the samples, and the woman in front of me tested positive for Stanzanol. And at the time, it was just undetectable in her sample. But now with better testing 8 years years on. So yeah, so fast forward, she fought it for a while and then she admitted it. So she was officially removed from the results and given a ban. In 2017, my husband and son and I got to fly to London and stand on the proper place on the podium with Joe Pavey of Great Britain, who had been fourth, but who, you know, really should have been third. It was a weird experience because it made me a little sad that we never had that. And that, you know, it was kind of like, here's your medals. Okay, let's get to the track meet. And I was like, no, we were those people. We just got robbed of that. But I did really, really appreciate it. And I think for both of us, she has two children and I have a child. And it just was like seeing them wave our flag. I think it meant more to me, honestly, 10 years out than it did 10 years earlier.
So you're informed about it by an answering machine message from a Sports Illustrated reporter. That's kind of funny.
Yeah, it's crazy. And actually, you know, they didn't have our medals that day. I just received my medal right as quarantine started, 12 and a half years.
What's going through your mind when you held it in your hands for the first time?
So I got flowers that morning from USA Track and Field, and they said, sorry, this took so long. So I knew. I was like, oh my God, it's actually coming. It's actually going to be here. And it showed up, and I was planning on two runs that day, and it showed up in the afternoon, and I didn't open it. I knew what it was.
What?
And I just told my husband, yeah, I don't know. I just said, I'm not ready, because I know this is going to make me feel a lot of feels. It's like a closure on this chapter that just never seems to end, but I'm just not ready yet. And so I went out and ran, and then we went out and picked up my favorite sushi. It was right at the start of quarantine, so there was no restaurants open, but they did have pickup. And meanwhile, while I was out running, my husband had organized a Zoom call. So anyway, we got back with the sushi, and then he and my son presented it to me, and my family got to watch. It was just weird, if I'm being honest. It was just like all of this emotion and thoughts and frustration over the last 12 years, and then it's just like, here it is. So, I mean, I'm happy to have it, and I'm really happy to close that chapter and move forward.
Did you have to give the bronze one back?
I didn't, and you know, I brought it to London in 2017 when we had that upgrade, and my son never knew that I won a medal. And in fact, when we moved to Portland, I almost gave my medal away to Goodwill because I had all these clothes stacked that I was giving away, and as we were loading them on the truck, the medal fell out. I probably only opened, I mean, when I won it, I showed it to everyone for like 3 months, but I had not opened that box in probably 8 years. When I got this call, I went into our basement and I found it. My son was like, you won this? Like, he didn't even know. So it was in great condition. So I just assumed that I would turn it in because it's like perfectly clean. It still had like the creases, how they set it in the box perfectly. So I brought it to London and they didn't ask for it back. So it's kind of funny. So I have a bronze medal, I have a placeholder silver medallion, and I have the silver medal. So I got 3 medals for one race.
In your opinion, what's the definition? If you were the Kara Goucher dictionary, what's the definition between banned and unethical?
Oh, that's a tough one, right? I like to keep it really simple and say, if it's on the ban list, don't do it. That eliminates a lot of the wondering for me. Like, if it's on this list, you just can't take it. Now, there's always people that are trying stuff. For instance, some of these thyroid medications, they may help your performance, but if you can get a doctor to prescribe it for you, that becomes more unethical, right? Because it's not actually banned. I just kind of want people to think like, okay, it becomes blurry, right? Because some people are going to take iron because they want to have better hematocrit and hemoglobin levels. And I get all that. And so where is the line where you say, no, you can't take anything? Some people are taking Advil because they're sore and they need to get through a workout. Well, are they unethical? So it's a really, really difficult line. So even though I do think there's a lot of unethical stuff that goes on, I really can't make that definition. And instead, I'll just say, if it's banned, it's banned. Follow the rules. It is not your right to compete at the highest level of sport. It is a privilege, and there are rules and regulations that you follow. And if you can't follow those rules, bye.
Well, at the top of the show, I introduced you as a 2-time Olympian, but you're actually 60 seconds from becoming a 3-time Olympian. For the listening audience, Nike developed these shoes that your competition carrier was wearing at the time trial, but you were not. The legal shoes alleged that they made the wearer run 4% faster. In that moment, do you regret kind of the whole breakup with Nike and not wearing them? By missing the Olympics by, what was it, 60, 65 seconds?
Yeah, look, I'll never regret leaving Nike. It just was not a company that aligns with who I am. And so, no. I feel sad that there's a possibility that I should have been on the third Olympic team. But again, we don't get to know. I don't get to go back in time and race that race over. And those Olympics have come and gone. What I want now is I don't want anyone to have to wonder like I do. You know, it's 4 years later and I still wonder. I think, well, the lab and research shows that some of of those athletes are getting a 5 to 6% advantage, and that's easily more than 60 seconds in a marathon at the pace we were running. But does that mean that I would have beat them? There's no way to know. So now my fight on the shoes is just that it's a level playing. This is one of those situations that's really tricky because you have one company that came out with it first, and it was kind of like when I raced in those trials, no one knew about the technology except for the athletes that were wearing it. But now we know about it. If we're going to allow this technology, what do we do to ensure that everyone has the same technology? And, you know, I've been disappointed with the regulations so far. I looked to swimming, which had suits, the full body suits, and people were swimming super fast. Swimming let them have it for a while. And then they went back and said, you know what, this is changing our sport in a way that we're not comfortable. And they went back and banned them. And all the time stood and all the performances stood. But they realized that the integrity of their sport was at stake. And I really, really hope that we get to some point like that with running. You know, the marathon is supposed to be hard. It's supposed to be a war of attrition. It's supposed to be physiologically really, really hard. And now we're seeing so many fast marathons, and we're seeing close races, and we're hearing athletes say, my legs, like, they felt great with the last 2 miles to go. Well, that's not the marathon, you know?
Right.
The marathon is supposed to be like you're dying, and that's what makes it so special, and that's what made it so hard and unique. So I just think World Athletics needs to really think about, what does this do for the future of the sport, and is that what they want? I'm sad to see the direction they've taken it so far, but I'm glad that they did set at least some guidelines so that we can have some sort of regulation there, because you know what, we really don't want to be seeing a shoe beat a shoe. We want to see an athlete beat an athlete.
While those shoes aren't banned, they certainly, I think we can both agree that they're unethical, and like you mentioned briefly, it's the Nike Vaporfly swimsuits too. They make a swimmer 4% faster. To backtrack just a second, I mean, it was your teammate that was wearing them, and it was your brother-in-law who helped develop the shoes. I mean, did your relationship suffer with either or both of them after that?
Yeah, I mean, it was really hard for me. I'm not going to lie. Just a lot of tears about, I mean, you know, I didn't know about the shoes. You know, I ran that race, I ran my heart out, and all three women that finished ahead of me are good women. They're good people, and they're really good athletes. Des has won Boston, Shalane has won New York, Amy Hastings won a bronze medal at the World Championships in the marathon. It's not like I lost to people that I didn't believe could beat me, you know? So I walked away from that, you know. My ego was hurt, but I lost this really amazing athlete. Finding out that maybe, and again, I cannot say for sure, but that maybe shoe technology affected the outcome, it's just really an icky feeling. And it leaves me a lot of the feeling of when I think about other races I've run in the past where certain athletes were in there that I knew weren't clean, and then I have to kind of wonder. And I'm not accusing them of being anything like a doper at all. It just leaves me with that feeling and that unknowing. And the fact that, you know, yeah, my brother-in-law developed that shoe and one of my close friends is wearing it, I have to remove that because I love them. I cried a lot about it, but I'm not going to let a shoe cost me my relationship with my family or with a former teammate who I really adore. Does it hurt? Yeah, it hurts. But you know what? Life is short. So I've moved on, mostly.
Yeah. But who, in your opinion, has the responsibility to make the decision now? Is it the Nike itself? Is it the company? Are there committees? What about, do the athletes just say, listen, we are stopping the use of it, whether it be the swimsuits or the shoes or the doping? Who ultimately is in control of stopping it?
Unfortunately, I mean, it's the governing bodies who don't seem to care. I think if you ask athletes, you know, we, on the Think Sport Collective, we asked a lot of athletes leading up to the marathon trials about the shoe technology, and 9 out of 10 hated it, but they said it's part of the game now. So why weren't these athletes consulted, right? Why didn't anyone talk to the athletes who are like, I don't like this. I don't like how the sport is changing. And same with doping. I feel like there's not a lot of, the athlete voice is supposed to be important, but I feel like it kind of falls on deaf ears. And when you become an athlete that speaks out, you're kind of labeled like a troublemaker. I do feel like athletes need to come together. And, you know, that's why we started the Team Sport Collective, as a place for like-minded people who want to see an end to this culture of doping, a place where they could go and share their frustrations and hopefully educate so that we can change the future. But the athletes need to really come together because they have more power than they think. Because at the end of the day, if the athlete decides to not compete, the governing bodies, the IOC, all the money poured in, it's nothing. You have to have the athletes. So the athletes do have power. They just need to figure out a way to come together and use that power to make change.
We're not just talking about the Olympics. I mean, this, all of this exists in your current phase of competition, which seems to be marathons now. And it directly applies to you because I looked up some places here. Kenyan Rita Jeptu, she won the 2013 Boston Marathon, the women's. She came in first place. You came in sixth. She tests positive for EPO, which is, by the way, Lance Armstrong's method of choice. First, for the listening audience, what is the benefit of EPO and what is the benefit of having more red blood cells?
So it increases your oxygen carrying capacity in your blood. So it allows you to train harder, to run farther. You just don't get as tired and you're able to push your body to new heights. It also can be used in recovery as well. So you recover quicker. So maybe you do a really hard session and then you would need 48 hours to recover from that. But if you're doing some of these drugs, you can be back at it day later or 2 days later instead of waiting for that third day. So it's right. And now you're training in a way that's not humanly possible, right? So now you're training in a way that I don't care how gifted and talented you are, you actually can't do that because your body will break down. EPO is a particularly icky drug. It's hard to detect. It just ruined the outcome of a lot of endurance events.
Years later, after all of you've been through, Kara, you've been fighting this, the good fight for how long, you're still up against it. How does that make you feel?
I'm not very fast anymore, and I really just run for fun, but I am very passionate about protecting the people who are still in it and the people who will be in it in 10 years. It's very frustrating, and I'll be honest, there are nights where I just am like, I'm over it. I can't do it. I cannot worry about this anymore. It's such a thankless position to be in. It just seems like it's never ending, and I think I'm done. I'm going to take all this time and energy and do something else with it. You know, and then you wake up the next day, and you're kind of fired up, and you decide to fight another day. Yeah, there are good days and bad days, but I mean, what's the alternative? I quit. And then I just say, you know what? You broke me. I can't let them break me. No way.
Being as invested as you are, I mean, we talked a little bit about gathering the athletes together, maybe a ban on competition or like a sit out, I guess, of competition. But what about incentivizing and empowering people like you who stand up and do the right thing? Is that a pragmatic solution to this?
Yeah, I do think that could be something really great. And our World Athletics president said this a couple of years ago. He said, we need to make whistleblowers feel safe and we need to reward them. Yet nothing's come of that. So mm-hmm. It was really just lip service. But I think it's always lonely, but I do feel like the more that people come out, the easier it can be. And I mean, you know, there are people who have made bad choices. In my opinion, then you can't be in sport anymore, but that doesn't necessarily make you a bad person. And you can take those bad choices and you can make really, really good change from it. So I think we need to really shift it so that we encourage whistleblowers to come forward. And you know, not every whistleblower has done something. There are plenty of athletes who have seen things that made them uncomfortable and left the situation, but they just didn't tell anyone. Anytime someone speaks up and we just try to destroy them in the media, that's not helping. I would really love to see a culture shift where people who tell the truth are rewarded. And I'm not, maybe not financially, but they're rewarded. They're given a place and we take them seriously.
And my final question is this, Kara, if you could look into a crystal ball right now in your quarantine house, tell me what the future says about your sport.
I love my sport so much. I love distance running so much. I am worried about where it's headed. I'm worried about the changes in the last 4 years due to shoe technology. I'm worried about the doping, but I have to keep taking myself back to happy moments. Seeing Shalane Flanagan win the New York City Marathon, seeing Desi Linden win the Boston Marathon, seeing Emma Coburn and Courtney Farrick go 1-2 in the steeplechase at the World Championships in 2017. There's so much joy and beauty to be had in it. I just think that if we remain focused on what our sport was meant to be, which is just like a competition of athlete versus athlete and nothing else, is supposed to be so pure. If we can really focus on the purity of it, I feel like we can get through it. And there's always going to be people taking shortcuts. There's just no way around it. If we can make the culture be that we celebrate the people doing it the right way, then I think we have a lot of beautiful times ahead.
Well, Kara, thank you so much for sharing your story with me and with my listening audience today. I really appreciate it.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me. It was fun. I was listening to a bunch of your podcasts. So thank you. This is cool. I feel special to be a part of your lineup.
Thanks for tuning in to episode 8 of Power Players powered by radio.com. To hear the stories of other power players in my women in sports lineup, search Power Players wherever you get your podcasts. Stay tuned to my social media channels for the announcement of my next guest at Coach MCCARTAN on Twitter and facebook.com/CoachMcCartan. See you next time.
Say yes to Pure Leaf Tea and free gas for a year only at True North Convenience Stores. When it comes to quality, say yes to the delicious taste of real brewed Pure Leaf Tea. True North stores are stocked with your favorite flavors like unsweetened, extra sweet, and raspberry. For a limited time, enter for a chance to win free gas for a year. Check the True Rewards app for details or download the mobile app from the Apple or Google Play stores. True North Convenience Stores. Fast, friendly, clean.
Take me out to the ball game.
What are you doing?
Did you know DirecTV has the most MLB games?
So you're singing?
Yeah, they put your favorite teams front and center right when you turn it on. Buy me some cold cuts and flapjacks.
Those aren't even the words.
I'm allergic to peanuts.
Stream DirecTV, home of the most MLB games. Visit DirecTV.com. Claim based on total games offered on national and regional sports networks. RSNs available with choice package or higher. Availability of RSNs varies by zip code and package.
Nerds!
Today's episode is sponsored by NerdWallet's Smart Money Podcast. Life comes with big money questions. Are target date funds a smart or lazy way to invest? Should you pay off debt or invest extra cash? Can you deduct your dog as a home security system on your taxes? NerdWallet's Smart Money Podcast has the answers. Their finance journalists break down investing strategies, tax planning, and smart ways to build wealth and navigate big financial decisions. Work smarter, not harder, on your finances this year. Follow NerdWallet's Smart Money Podcast wherever you listen.
It's that time of year again. My schedule is packed with bracket-busting, three-point shooting, nonstop basketball action. I don't want to miss a second of it. That's why I go for a five-hour energy shot. They're perfect for my days packed with back-to-back games, or whenever my favorite team is playing late. 5-Hour Energy keeps me going during the broadcast and the next morning when I need to get myself up and to work. Visit 5hourenergy.com for great deals and to stock up before tip-off.
Street Easy knows former New Yorkers never stop talking about how much they miss living in NYC.
Life used to feel like a movie, but since we left and bought a house, it's like living in a DIY home repair video.
When it's time to buy, let Street Easy connect you with the right agent you need to never leave NYC. Go to StreetEasy.com to learn more. Street Easy is an assumed name of Zillow Inc., which has licenses in all 50 states.